You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Welcome, everybody. This is Curiosity Invited, and I'm David Bryan, and I have the great pleasure of speaking with someone I've known in some ways for many years, and in other ways, and hardly at all. And that is Katalin Hanapi. And look at that, I've said it twice correctly.
So, yeah, so that's good. We practiced a little bit.
So let me just tell you a little bit about her. Katalin Hanapi is a documentary filmmaker. Katalin grew up in Austria, Canada, England, and the United States, which is where I met her. What was constant in her life was storytelling and family. Katalin discovered her passion for theater and screenplay writing. In her early 20s, she wrote plays for theaters in Vienna, but then decided to enroll in film school and soon started working as a documentary filmmaker. Over 10 years later, Katalin has directed more than three dozen documentaries for broadcast and cinema, most of them in the genre of wildlife, adventure, science, and nature. Together with her partner, she runs a design studio. Together, they recently started the production company Sailing Studio Productions that produce little fun short films with big meanings. But when I look at the list of films, it's like, you made a lot of films in a short period of time.
Yeah, I was crazy, like a workaholic. But that was really because I waited for such a long time to find what I want to do. Mm-hmm. That when I started, which was only, 25, I felt like I have to really get going now.
Do you think of yourself as a person who reinvents herself?
I like your questions already. I don't reinvent myself, but what I do is I like to go back to certain points and gather up certain qualities or talents that I had and that I've forgotten. Like right now I'm at this point where I've done a lot of films and I've come to the point where I felt like I know my craft already too much. I know I was like I was on fire. And a couple of years ago, I've lost that. I felt like I started getting too comfortable, being too much in the comfort zone.
Why do you see that as too comfortable and not just I know my craft?
Because I could see it in the films. I could see it in the products. I could see that it was lacking fire. It was lacking my intuition. Because I started making films out of pure intuition, meaning, and instinct. If you don't really know what you're doing, you just go there and then you work with what you have. And I felt like I've lost that. And these films are working perfectly for television, but there is something missing and it doesn't inspire me anymore. It doesn't challenge me anymore. And I felt like, gosh, I'm in my 30s and I might make films until I'm, I don't know, hopefully 80 or something like that. And so what does that mean? Another 40 or 50 years of showing up.
Of the same thing.
Routine. Working with the same people. And so I felt like, to go back to your other question of reinventing myself, I felt like I have to go into the beginner's mind. I have to become a beginner again, but I have to become that within a field where I already kind of know the craft. So I thought, well, the best way and the easiest way to do it is to just take on another skill. So I just ordered a set of equipment, very small, like a small DSLR camera and a gimbal, which is like a small steady cam that's not too heavy to carry for me. Mm-hmm. And then, in 2021, which was a very which was a bit of a turn point of a year. I just booked a flight to Namibia, which is a very dear and important country for me, with my little equipment setup. And I met a friend of mine, and we just made a film together. And I filmed all of it. And it was, oh, my mind was exploding. It was crazy. It was sandy. It was hot. There was glaring sun. And I was carrying that equipment. And I was back to sweating and being scared and being like, oh, my God, can I do this? Because we really set ourselves a goal. So we really said, okay, there must come film out of that. And that's the thing, yes. I thought a good first step is to not have a client that I have to, you know, work into a certain pattern. Mm-hmm. And this little film is different. It doesn't follow any rules at all, but it follows the rules of storytelling. You know, that's what I believe. It works or it doesn't work.
Well, what's the story of this film?
Well, the story of that film is there's an indigenous community in Namibia that is one of the oldest in the world. They refer to themselves as Bushmen, but we can call them the Sun. And so they have a little piece of land in Namibia, which is way too small for them to live the way they used to live, which is hunting and gathering. Mm-hmm. And so their ways of doing things are starting to change. But there are still elders in the group that still know how to track, and they know how to hunt, and they know how to survive and to find roots that they can drink out of when there's no water. And it's quite astonishing. And they know how to gather which plants, and they have all this really ancient knowledge and ancient way of living. But then there's the young generation, which have smartphones, and you know, they drink Coca-Cola, and they also have issues like a lot of like plastic on their land, and alcoholism is a problem too. So we told the story of a young girl that's a teenager. She's 16, and she's leading through the story, and you see how she's both, you know, trying to put together her world that is so divided with young children that are so, you know, tapping into modernist Western lifestyles, and then her grandmother and her father who still know all the old ways. So it's a short film, but it's
what's it called in English?
Call it Aya's Dream. Aya means mother, and it's the name of the girl, so we call it Aya's Dream.
Is it done?
Well, yes, it's done. We're now sending it to festivals.
Ah, when you watch it, are you happy with it?
Well, I am proud of it because of the visual work. Because it turned out, I really can say that it turned out beautifully, and I'm happy with it. But I'm also confused about it because it is different. It's not told in the usual way. It's a little bit abstract. You know, it's abstract, and you don't know, is the girl dreaming? Is she dreaming about herself when we see an old lady? Is that her when she was young, or is that her grandmother? Mm-hmm. So I don't do a lot of explaining in this film. And in documentaries with the narrator, you usually explain most of it. You hear the people that we film talking in their click language. They make the little click sound. It's a beautiful language. Yeah. Yes. So we have subtitles translating that. Mm-hmm. But I love just not explaining everything.
And
nice.
Okay, so but tell me again. So you went to Namibia. You didn't know, you knew you were going to make a film. You didn't have a story already. The story emerged from your experiences.
That's right. Well, what was similar? Let's say what was the same was that I could easily fail. I think it was more that. Mm-hmm. I knew that this is now a skill that I'm only learning, and I have to just survive doing it. Just like I learned, you know, riding the bike. My parents just put me on a bike and pushed me down a hill, and I just learned to survive. that's just how it went. And it's very similar with filmmaking. I do it with myself now. I throw myself into there and I know somehow I'll make it. And it's the fastest way to learn. Because you're yes. there, your brain goes into a state of survival and it works faster. It just, you know.
I just had this, I had this image of your parents deciding one day to teach you to swim by throwing you into the deep end.
No, I think, I don't actually remember how I learned swimming. I wish I did, but I learned how to crawl only 4 years ago. And my partner taught me how to crawl. Do you call that crawling?
Oh, you mean in the water? You don't mean.
Yes, water. No, not crawling. No.
I suddenly had this image of your partner teaching you to crawl.
Like, that's your need.
Is it an important skill to learn after a while? I met you when you were.
Yes, I was 12, and I think it was. I was in the middle, New Roads Middle School, and it was, yes. I think, the first year of the middle school. Different, but I came from the Austrian educational system, which is very strict. It's very strict. And not only the headmaster is like the Pope.
It's like the mayor.
Like the mayor, yeah, you barely speak to them. I did because I was always in trouble and I had to go see the headmaster. But your teachers, you wouldn't call them by their first names. You would have to stand up when they entered the room. You called them professor, so-and-so. And you were only allowed to speak when they asked you a question. And it was very strict. And it was not creative. We had, I think, an hour of sports. We had an hour of art a week. Yeah. Yeah. And you came up and you were the Pope and you approached me and I started going into what I was used to, like almost not looking at you, just going shy. And you came and gave me a hug. And that was something that didn't happen in the schools that I knew. And you didn't only do it on the first day of school to make me feel welcome and comfortable and wanted. You did it throughout the whole year. Whenever you saw me, you gave me a hug and I was allowed to call you David. And all the other teachers, they were like that too. And it was something, it was your quality, but I think you probably, the teachers that you chose to teach at your schools, I'm sure you looked at that quality in them. There was this one quality of everybody looking at us children, and I was just a kid, I was 12, I looked like an 8-year-old, a quality of almost, well, treating them as like on eye level and seeing what's special in each one of them. And that is something that I find is the most important thing in the world you can do to a child, is to look at them as a full-grown person and listen to what they have to say. Because sometimes they are more wise than they'll be 30 years later. Children are, it's unbelievable. And you did that. And it was really forming for me. There's a connection happened 24 years ago.
Oh, yeah, somehow that's
you
true.
You formed me already as I am now, as I'll be in 20 years and 40 years.
Yeah.
Saw that already.
And there's some clue there about how life ought to be.
Yeah, I it was astounding. And like I mentioned before, the school I came from, where you just had an hour of art and an hour and sports, and it was all with it was always in combination with a lot of pressure. And then I went to New York, New Roads, and suddenly I had art in a way like I've never experienced it. And so I didn't know what drama was. I didn't know what it means to stand in a group of people and play and act out roles, and that was fantastic. We had fencing. We had cooking lessons. I was introduced to yoga. And I mean, to everybody who's European that might listen to this will be like, oh, that's so stereotypical for a California school to have yoga. And it was maybe, but it was unbelievable. But then, of course, we had math and everything. It wasn't just fun. Yeah. We had other subjects. But I remember even math, the teacher, who was fantastic too, he was sitting on the table, like writing on the projector. And we had a test every week, and the best one would win a cinema ticket. So we were rewarded. We were rewarded, you know, and I do this until today. I always reward myself for whatever I do, with food, with massage, with whatever I like to do. So I came back to Austria after that time in Los Angeles, and I came back to my school, but I took all of that with me. I took it all with me. I had this whole experience of knowing what it feels like to be seen as a child, and to know what it feels like to, you know, Antonia, the drama teacher, she would give me a feeling of that I'm funny and I'm entertaining and that I'm really good in doing that. And I was kind of a shy kid coming there. And I came back much less shy. I came back very sure of myself, which is great for a teenager. You know, the beginning of teenage years when, yeah, things start going crazy. And it was the perfect start to go back to Austria. And so what happened then was a friend of mine, she told me that there's a casting for television. She doesn't really, like, she took me to have a look at that. And I did the casting, and I didn't tell my mom anything about it. And it was a casting for a television show, which was a news program that was presented by children for children. And so I did the casting, and there were hundreds of children. And I still carried that thing inside me, which was, I can do that. Sure, I'll stand there. I'll do it. Bring it on. And so I just went to that casting, and they picked that up, and they made me the presenter of that show, and I was 13 then. And then for 4 years, every Saturday and Sunday, me and my Kenny, who I was presenting the show with, we were doing our job, and I made a little bit of pocket money.
And what was the leap, or what was the move from being a news anchor to making a film?
For 4 years, like, Austria could watch me, you know, with glasses, with braces, with short hair, with long, growing up. And then I was 17, my mom again decided to move to Brighton because she felt like it. She felt like, I think Brighton's a great city, let's move there. So we did. and I had another great experience with a really good college there. It's amazing to then start thinking about, with that catalog, what do I actually like? What interests me? Because that is, for some people, the beginning of taking like a turn into where they want to go. And so I just, so I was supposed, you know, my mom wanted me to pick math and French and all the stuff, because I still had to go back to Austria to do the proper, how do you call it? Like the final exams.
To get a degree. To get a college degree.
Yes. Yes. She said I have to get the Austrian one, the proper one. I took six subjects, and it was art, it was dance, it was French, I think it was photography. So I just took the stuff that I liked. And that's kind of when I also noticed that I find it a bit boring just to stand in front of the camera, because we just got handed a text that we were learning by heart and saying to the camera. And I always felt like I wrote into that very crazy bio that you had to read in the beginning. I came from, you know, writing stories myself and directing little films with my siblings as actors. And that was, and I think the best thing, or a very good thing that can happen to you, is that when you do something in life, and get paid for that, which you already enjoyed doing as a kid in your free time when nobody would pay you.
Right.
You did it out of pure joy. Yeah, so I felt like that is way more me than being a performer. I feel more like a creator than a performer. And I think performers create and creators perform, blah, blah, blah. But I felt more comfortable on the other side.
Where do your ideas for films come from? Like what? I mean, this the Namibia story, right?
Is,
yeah. was so unusual, right? It was you quite intentionally wanted to do something that was different from what you were doing.
Style-wise. I mean, Namibia has a huge meaning for me. Because
where were we before we were so rudely interrupted by life?
As usual, I started talking about Namibia.
Yes. So I asked that question, that incredibly unfair question. Where do your ideas come from? Your ideas for films?
Wow. And I love this question because I have to ask myself that. But with this particular one, with Aya's Dream, with that short film, I went to Namibia because if I rewind back 6 years before that, 2015, I was commissioned a director's job that was really life-changing, life-shaping for me, or I don't know how you say it, character-shaping for me. I had to do a wildlife conservation series for young people, and I was there for over 3 months. And we were filming every day, and it was really about saving African species in this.
And this was in Namibia?
That was in Namibia. And I didn't know anything about Africa before that. I got the job and I was sent there, and it was unbelievable what Africa or Namibia, I don't know what happened with me on this continent. And I still can't really explain. I can't put my finger on it, what it was exactly. It was, I think, the combination of just breathtaking nature and people that are very grounded, talking about the Namibians now, the locals, very grounded and very connected. And they really, truly look at you, look into your eyes. They're with you in that moment. Laugh about silliest things. You can forget the world with them. They dance and sing, and there is so much joy. And I forgot all about that.
Do you mean, are you specifically referring to the people that the bush people that you described before, or people in the country generally?
People in the country.
Yeah.
People in the country. And I was filming this summer in Tanzania also for 2 months, and it happened again. So it must be something with just the African continent.
And what do you mean you forgot about that? You'd forgotten
that.
Well,
the last time that I remember being entirely silly and having fun and dancing in the rain and throwing myself onto the floor, and it was probably childhood. And I mean, we had to work also. We were working in the morning and in the afternoon when the sun was nice. But I just had so many beautiful connections, and I saw animals that I've never seen before in the wild. That is the crazy thing about Namibia. You have wild, iconic animals that I've known from the zoo or from books. Yes. Roaming around free, they cross the street, you know, and in the best case scenario, humans and wildlife in some parts of Namibia, in many parts actually, have learned to live there peacefully together. They found ways to coexist together, and it was really inspiring. And I mean, I saw a lion, I looked into the eyes of a real lion, and you actually wake up with them because they roar in the dawn, in the morning and in the evening. And it's very hard to explain, but I felt like I was being totally grounded. And what happened with me in the feeling of being grounded is being like a child again, finding into that very untamed, very wild person that me and everybody else is, but not everybody gets the chance to rediscover that, because in our society, more so probably in Western countries, we learn to be good girls and good boys and to do our jobs, and and that going crazy can be weird, you know. I came back from Africa with that same attitude of smiling at everybody I met on the street, and people think you're a crazy woman if you do that. What does she want from me? Why is she smiling? She probably wants money or whatever. So so I'm glad that I saw that there's this way of life too, and it changed something in me. It opened something up. Not only did I then discover that wildlife conservation and animals, wildlife and nature are topics that excite me and touch me in my heart, and are stories that I want to tell everybody about. I also discovered that how important that untaming and wild part is too, that we carry in us. I came back and did one film after the other. What I had changed was when I came back then and I ended my 10-year relationship with a wonderful man who's now my best friend. And I moved house and I decided to only do films that really interest me, but they were usually commissioned. Like, yes. So I got a call and they said, listen, Katalins, we have a series about the national parks, because people knew I like nature. Do you want to do it? So I always took the topics, and there was enough fascination for me to make a film about it. But what I didn't do, and which is something that I'm now changing, is your question that you asked, where do my ideas come from? Mm-hmm. I have to ask myself that, because I think the best pieces of work you can do are the ones when something spills out of you. And I was asking myself for a long time, what is the story that I really want to tell? And what is the story that only I can tell with who I am, or with how I am, and with what I've experienced? And there are a few topics that are now starting to excite me, where I'm thinking I'm going to make a film out of that question or out of that feeling. And then I developed a story around that feeling, that urge to talk about something. It's very in a very exploratory state right now. There is something that we've touched upon before in our conversation, and that has to do with children and empowering children, and it has to do with children having to be grown-ups very early on in life, way before they have to. That is something that is really, I don't know if there's a lot out there yet. I'm sure there is. There are great stories out there, but there is a story I need to tell. What I don't know yet is, will it be a documentary or will it be fictional? So I'm now starting to also allow myself to think, you know, allow myself to maybe create fictional films. I think it'll be a gang of kids that are, and it's summer vacation, and they all have their own issues at home, and there are parallel stories with the parents and this group that is doing something that I cannot say. Yeah. But there are many stories like that out there. There are many coming of age stories, and I still have to I still have to decide, do I want to watch, I made myself a list of 25 films that are Lord of the Flies and all these films that are in that genre. And I have this piece of paper lying in my office. And I don't know if I should start watching the films, because I don't want to steal. I don't want to put images into my head and then wonder were they in there or did I see them? No. So should I maybe start writing first? I have so many, I have pictures of my head when I think of artists. And my stepdad, which you've met in LA, in Los Angeles, he's an artist. I was young. My mom was married to him for 8 years, and he was very much in the art world. And I remember just witnessing as a child how intimidating these people could be. And they were to my mom, who's a professor who comes from education, who never gave herself the permission to be a writer or an artist herself. But her then husband, he took her into that art world, and I just watched as a child. I just saw how intimidated my mom was by those people that put themselves into scene, the way they dress and speak. And so I always had a bit of a negative connotation.
Well, both, I mean, it's probably true in every field. People who really think of themselves, like that the label that the world gives them, you know, is an important one. I'm a teacher, I'm a professor, I'm a politician, I don't care what it is, I'm an artist. And it means, and it's a thing, it's like a, well, back to that conversation about formulas, right?
Labels you, like if you went to, let's say, your class reunion 30 or 40 years later, and then you have somebody say, well, I became the head of this museum, and I became a film director, and I became this scientist. And then there's one saying, well, I work in the supermarket. I mean, it's terrible that we have labels. And I don't like it. I find it really hard to label myself an artist, even a filmmaker, or a scientist, because I know I have a part in me that is nerdy and scientific. And with my films, I love to just put the magnifying glass on a small detail, which is a very scientific way of approaching something and then making it huge and exploring it. I could refer to myself as a journalist too, because I went to, like, I have a journalist degree. But I don't see myself as that person that I think of when I speak of journalists.
Yeah.
It's very hard. I mean, but then also it's nice to refer to yourself as an artist.
People fix whatever labels are. None of them are necessarily constraining unless a person wants them to be, unless the person, I wish there was more freedom within the categories, right? And it didn't feel like such a constrained thing. But you know, you're a filmmaker because and I'm not forcing you into this label, but you're a filmmaker because when you think about, at least today, when you think about what you might want to do or what story you want to tell, the tools you use include this thing that, you know, not everybody knows how to do. And it doesn't mean you're only a filmmaker, or it doesn't mean you have to only be a whatever.
How would you call
the story? The story of your vita, right? Your curriculum vita, your CV. The story of your CV is one of somebody who points lenses at things and then uses what she accumulates from that to communicate something, a message. And that's great.
I do it. Even the dark parts, not just the light parts. Like, there's darkness along that journey, and there's very difficult times, very difficult childhood. And now there's also that huge pain of losing my dad 2 years ago, which is a form of grief like I've never experienced it before. And I feel like, but what a gift to be able to also explore the dark parts, because then you can, like, the way on the light parts is different. And I feel like that is what shapes me, as what makes me a filmmaker, in the sense that I want to be a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Is all of that. So our vita is part of that, and it's not schools you went to, and they also are, but it's all the lines in between.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that shapes you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps me. It's almost like a protection or a guard, that when life throws something very challenging at me, I don't feel so much as a victim.
Mm-hmm.
I feel more like, okay, wow, that's another way to understand life more thoroughly and deeply. And it makes me better in what I do, and it makes me more vulnerable as a storyteller and more broad. So it's a gift that I have for this life, to be able to tell stories. It makes life a bit more easy. Yes, and that's why I want to, you know, like I mentioned, explore difficult childhood and tell those stories too, because I wish that as a child I would have found books or films where I, as a child, felt understood with what I'm going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel there could be more stories out there, you know? So those are the stories that you have to go through pain and to get all of that out and then form it into something. But if I think about that person reading that, and it helps them to feel understood and not alone in this world, I feel like, wow, there's finally purpose to what I'm doing. And it's different if you get a commission for a film and they give you a topic and they say, make a film about, I don't know, this species,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
You can do that. You can be fascinated and then tell the story and fascinate others.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel I have another calling, and I'm kind of taking a curve right now from the.
This is a really different moment in your life, right? I feel like I've re-met you at this moment in your life where you're exploring in that way. It's ripe and open and unknown yet, right? It's and yet feels very just the tone of your voice as it changes as you're speaking about it is sort of, it carries a weight.
Yeah, of course it does, but you met me when I was 12 and
I know. Yeah, that's interesting.
It was.
Well, maybe that's what I do. Maybe I just check in every 24 years. And
David Brian.
Well,
I think that's what you do with people. I feel like that's what you've been doing, you know?
I don't know. I hope that's true.
Yeah.
Be nice.
But for me, and there's one.
That's right. There's one.
That's nothing.
Yeah. So you have plans for you. Do you have plans for the world? Like, are you trying to make the world a better place in a particular way?
Well, I'm trying
or,
to not
or a worse place or something. Or
I'm trying better. Not to be worse. Well, I come from generation, what I call generation helpless. When it comes to climate change, I've spoken to people that know a lot about it, that have told me, you know, it's kind of late. But then I had the privilege and the amazing joy to speak with Jane Goodall. I interviewed her in last May. And she is astonishing. She's 87, I think now 88 years old. And she is working over 10 hours a day right now from Bournemouth in the house that she grew up with. And she's giving talks and interviews and Zoom meetings, one after the other. She's approaching 90 years. And her thing is hope.
Yes.
And she says hope is all we have. And so she works with thousands of children through her project Roots and Shoots across the planet. And she meets so many people. And when you speak with her and afterwards, you feel like, yeah, it's possible. Like even planting one tree or, I don't know, doing one thing less that is not good for the planet, but one thing that is good for, even that makes a little change. And so so I feel like it's very, that's all I can do. Because you asked me if I want to change this world. I know that I can't solve all the problems, but I can try my best and hopefully be a good influence to the people around me.
Well, she's a hero of mine, as you know, and she's probably a hero of everybody's. Anybody with any sense, she'd be the hero of them. So funny, I was about 2 months ago, I spoke with a fellow named Brent Green, who's not, and not anybody would know, but.
Don't say that. I hope he never hears that.
he thinks of himself that way, but the truth is he's an incredible person. And he has actually periodically been recognized for what he's done, which is, you know, he had a fascination with plants from the time he was a little kid. And you know, happily when he was going off to college and, you know, thinking about, you know, his dad saying, what do you think you're going to study? And him saying, well, you know, I think I'd like to be a lawyer like you. And his dad said, well, but what about, you mean you spend so much time in the garden and you love plants? And he's like, he said, yeah, but that you really can't make a living doing that. And his dad happily exposed him to but there's this whole other thing, you know, this horticulture and landscape design and yada yada yada. Well, so he went to study horticulture, landscape design. He became a horticulturist and landscape architect. His work is crazy beautiful. Like I've never seen anything like it. I've never even imagined anything like it. His backyard is, it's like walking from this nice little house into a magnificent outdoor room. It is, I mean, it's so both intimate and grand and extraordinary. And it's a yard. I mean, it's, you know, it's amazing. But and that's not even the best thing he does. So when he grew up at first in I think it was Leimert Park, and then they moved. He's a black guy from Los Angeles, and what he could afford when he could afford was, you know, of this tiny little house in the hood in Los Angeles, right? In a not so great area, you know, murders and crime but it was his house, and he was going to, it was the little piece of the planet that he had some control over. So he started transforming both his own house, and then he had the idea. He was about to turn 35, and he was going to plant 35 trees on his street. And so, you know, he planted his, and then he went door to door, and, you know, some people didn't want anything, any part of it. And some people said, sure, that's great, you know, whatever. And he planted 35 trees. And then the next year he planted 36 trees. And then the next year, and when you go to his house, you're driving through what is you know, it's Los Angeles, and it's the concrete part of Los Angeles. There's nothing particularly appealing about it at all. And then you turn, and it's like, what is this? So he plant, I mean, it's tree-lined streets. He did his street, and then the next street, and the next street. And he was at some point recognized, you know, they call him the urban Johnny Appleseed. And he's, you know, one tree at a time transformed this neighborhood into just this extraordinary place, you know. And I actually, you know, I think the weirdest thing about the world is that, one of us the weirdest, because I'm pretty weird, but one of the weird things about the world is we get our sense of how the world is often from news, right? People watch television, unlike you, right? I mean, streaming and that's, but and journalism, you know, the tellings of things that happen, and so much of what's happened in the world is nothing, right? Like, you know, there were no murders today in this town that I live in. No one was killed. And that's not news by definition. News is sort of, by definition, the things that are usually problems. And the accumulation of those little snippets of something that's gonna fit into a news story paints this picture of the world as filled with problems. And there are problems. I mean, there's no doubt there's bad stuff in the world. But, I hope you don't hang up on me after I say this next sentence, but I think when you look at you'll excuse the expression, when you look at the data, of as best data we can get about what's gone on and what's been going on and what is, there definitely are problems. Climate change is a problem, but so many things are actually so much better than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago, than they have ever been. There are fewer people by some enormous percentage. There are fewer people starving today than ever before, fewer percentage-wise, right? The world is so much more, despite what's happening in Ukraine, which is terrible, and we need to do something about that. But there is so much less violence than there used to be. But we wouldn't get that, we don't get that picture from a picture of the world that is put together by news, because news almost by definition is looking for what went wrong. And so there's a lot of, because I know that Jane Goodall exists, and because I've spent time, not recently sadly, but with young people so much of my life, and because, you know, you sort of take that stance back and you realize, I have so much hope. So I think Jane Goodall is a genius, right? You know, it's like hope is exactly the thing. And there is so much to be hopeful for. And yes, there's so many things that still need to be, for lack of a better term, fixed and undone. And, yes. but it's not hopeless. She's right.
It's not hopeless. There were so many amazing things you just said.
You didn't hang up on me, so.
No, great. I don't. No, not at all. Not at all. I underline every, highlight everything you said. And I think you have to find in this world a balance of how much do I protect myself from negativity, but not shield it out entirely, because becomes ignorance and blindness. And how much do I let positivity in and good news? And How can I make more good news and help as much as possible with the bad news? And I think that is the only humane way to do it. Because even though we love superheroes, and maybe some people come closer to being superheroes, like probably Chengudo is one of them.
Yeah.
But as much as we love superheroes, we're all just humans. And we can only do as much. And I think a lot of also young people are way, they're totally overwhelmed with everything that's happening. And yeah. And so if they have people like you, grown-ups, to help them navigate through this world, then it would help a little bit this generation helpless. It would help to find a little bit, have a bit more orientation in all of that.
Are you a grown-up yet?
No. Well, I'm a mixture because I had to be very grown-up very early on. In life, I just had to, you know, solve problems that I was too young for, but also I could understand things earlier, I think. And then I'm very naive in other aspects. I'm not a grown-up when it comes to business making. I'm a child there.
I mean,
you look fine. I mean, your hair is cut, your clothes, you've got a good bumper on. You look like you have life in order.
Oh, yeah, I know how to do that.
That's a good grown-up.
I know. I can play the part. I can definitely play the part. I remember when going back to that school that we met at, right?
That school that we met at, you mean the school that you ran?
Yes.
That really made you sound like a child now. Like we went to school together.
But that's what I was going to say. It's like, you know, when the room got quiet, when the rooms got quiet, people looked at me. And I never really got used to it. I realized at some point, okay, this is my role. So I have to do something now. But I always wanted to, and I still to this day, I want to, like, when I'm having a conversation with other adults, it's like, I can't believe that nobody in the room is like going, is like, can you believe we're actually having this conversation? Like, it's like we're grownups, because I feel like I play the part. So I was playing the part of head of school. I was the head of the school, and so I had certain things I had to do, and okay, I can do those things, but most of my time I spent hanging out with the kids, and it's like, why the hell would I want to be around grown-ups?
I just said exactly that 2 days ago. I was in Napoli in Naples just a few days ago with the nephews of my partner. They're 13 and 11. And I had the time of my life with these guys. I had so much fun. I had the best conversations. They were starting to think about parallel universe. They said, imagine if that piece of bread was lying there, that would change that and that and that in the parallel universe. And they just took me to amazing places. When I compare that to meeting my girlfriends, which I also love, but I just come home tired because we talked about problems for hours. We would try to find solutions. We discuss things, look at it from all sides. But with these kids, I just had fun. I had so much. We did knock knock jokes for 2 hours straight. And, yeah, they're amazing.
Okay. Tell me a knock knock joke.
Knock knock.
Who's there?
Wait, I don't know if I had, but I actually it's my favorite one. So okay. I have it right here because I wrote it on my phone. Okay, knock knock.
Who's there?
A little old lady.
A little old lady who?
Hey, you can yodel. I just love those. I love those.
Oh. Well, this is probably more fun than it's supposed to be.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.